Our next case today is number 073762, National Athletic Sportswear Incorporated against Westfield Insurance Company. Mr. Beverstedt.
Mr. Clark. Good morning. My name is Mark Beverstedt, and I'm here on behalf of National Athletic Sportswear. National Athletic Sportswear suffered a theft loss and has been prevented from recovering over $350,000 in damages because the district court granted summary judgment. The district court found that Westfield Insurance Company acted reasonably as a matter of law when it insisted on a second day of questioning Mr. Snyder, the president of NAS, after he'd already been questioned for over 8 hours.
What language in the contract required Westfield to stop with one day?
The contract states that they have the right to question Mr. Snyder at such times as may be reasonably required.
Right. So that times plural makes me think that two times can't possibly be a problem under this contract.
One cannot.
If it's not like 15 or 20 times, surely, you know, at some point it would be harassment. But I don't see language in the contract that limits, as strictly as you seem to think, the number of times there can be these examinations under oath.
One cannot possibly determine whether a second EUO or a third or a fourth or a fifth is reasonable without first looking at what happened during the first examination under oath and what is being proposed during the second examination under oath. You have to look at that in order to determine whether it's reasonable. It may be
the
three or four.
The Supreme Court doesn't seem to have seen it your way. They've had several of these examination under oath cases.
The only one that I'm aware of that the Supreme Court has decided is the Morris case. And you have to look at the Morris case for what happened there. There's two critical factors that occurred in the Morris case that I think this Court should consider. First of all, that case, as well as the other two cases that have followed the Morris reasoning, were cases in which the insured refused to sit for a single EUO. And what the Indiana Supreme Court said in the Morris case is that, quote, a single request for a statement under oath from the insured is reasonable on its face. That is what it held. And no one disagrees with that. There's no question that an insurance company has a right to ask for an examination under oath. No one disputes that fact. But when an insured has already been questioned for over 7 hours, with repetitious questions and with the conduct that Westfield Insurance Company conducted prior to that time, then a question of fact exists for a jury to determine whether or not that second EUO is reasonably required.
But I don't see any case that has said that. I don't see limiting language in this policy. This is not a discovery rule. It's a contract.
Well, we have
it seems to me you need you need some authority for saying that this doesn't mean what it seems to say.
As parties and as attorneys, we have to look at what is reasonable under the circumstances. And in this particular situation, there is no precedent that says that two is reasonable as a matter of law. There is not.
Especially when they finish the first one by saying, you know, we'll continue later, or words to that effect, and there are new documents that are going to be discovered, and maybe the new documents throw additional light on things that have already been discussed. It seems to me your case is a really tough one for showing that this is unreasonable, if we had to do that.
Well, what you have to understand is we propose that he question Mr. Snyder on any matter that he wanted to, as long as he agreed not to rehash areas that had already been covered.
But where did you have the right to put conditions on Mr. Snyder's examination? That's the question.
Well, the logical point here, let's use an example. What if Westfield had said, we want a second day of questioning, and we're not going to go into new materials. We're going to cover the same questions that were already asked that would be subject to an objection to already asked and answered. Would that be reasonably required?
It says they at such times as may be reasonably required. It doesn't say on such subject matters. It says at such times as may be reasonable.
And so we were not preventing Westfield from having a second day of questioning as long as they agreed not to cover the same topics.
I don't see anything wrong with your hypothetical because I don't see what's unreasonable about the time. You're saying it would be unreasonable about the subject matter, but where does this contract clause talk about subject matter?
Because you can't determine
any matter.
You can't possibly determine whether that is a reasonable second request without looking at the subject matter. You cannot divorce the two.
Why not, under this contract language?
Because
couldn't you have written a contract that said at such times and about such subject matters as may be reasonable?
Well, first of all, my client didn't write the insurance contract. And insurance contracts must be construed against the insurance company. And Indiana law also
says...
Only
if they're ambiguous, though. If they're not ambiguous, you read them according to their
exactly.
plain language.
But the question here is where it says reasonable times as are required. Does that mean that the insured has a right to question, why do you want to go through a second day of questioning after you've already questioned for 7 hours? What's the purpose for it? I think that is a reasonable inquiry in order to determine whether a second day of questioning is reasonably required.
You may ask that question. I understand that what you're asking. It's not clear to me why you decided to go to the mats on this. You know, so Mr. Snyder spent a second day having questions. He stood to gain a lot if he could have convinced Westfield that the loss of those copyright designs was worth more than Westfield had assessed it at.
Mr. Snyder felt that he had been harassed at that point. He sought new counsel. I sought what I thought was a reasonable way to deal with a dispute. If Westfield had simply said, hey, I'm not going to rehash issues, I'm just going to cover the new materials that have been produced, and I think I can get this done in 3 hours, I would have said, fine, let's pick a day, let's go. But when he refuses to do that, when they refuse to agree to that, what does that say to an attorney? It says that he does not agree to that proposal. He was free to question, Westfield was free to question my client on any matter as long as they didn't rehash matters that had already been
asked. He probably didn't want an objection from you that something was rehashing where he thought it was really trying to understand something in a new light based on the new information. I don't know, but it seems to me that they didn't want to tie their hands. And this contract language doesn't say they have to.
The logic suggests then that an insurance company can do whatever they wish with an insured at a statement under oath, and that a counsel for the insured has no right to stand up to any type of behavior that they believe is abusive. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Beaverstein. We'll hear now from Mr. Clark.
Good morning, Your Honors, and thank you.
So let me ask you the same question. Why did this blow up into something that comes to the Court of Appeals when, unless Westfield was really planning on something hideously abusive, some common ground might have been met?
Not at all, Your Honor. We found this to be a very complex case. I'm the one who took the UO originally. There were thousands of documents that were presented. It was at no small labor and cost to prepare for that. The UO was as efficiently conducted as possible. During the course of the UO, it became apparent that there were documents that were not produced. This is a matter of record. And Mr. Snyder indicated that he had not gotten to those, would look for them, would produce them. They were subsequently produced, again, I believe over 1,200 pages at that point in time, which, as you noted in your questions to Mr. Beaverstad, did in fact deal with matters, subject matters that had been discussed in the prior EUO, but did shed a totally different light on those issues. Mr. Beaverstad has made it clear throughout the course of this proceeding and what is abundantly clear in the record, and that is that he would not allow any matter, subject matter, with the terms that he used repeatedly, both in his letters, in his response to the motion for summary judgment, and in his appellate brief, that he would not allow any subject matter to be addressed that had already been covered in the prior EUO. I could not agree to that, Your Honor. If I had, I would have been limiting my client to restrictions that were not limited in the policy, as you pointed out. That was impermissible because there were a number of matters that had to be rehashed, at least I thought possibly, during the course. And until we engaged that EUO, it could not be determined. And that is why. Indiana law is very clear on this point. the Morris case is crystal clear. Judge Springman didn't just decide that what was done was reasonable. What Judge Springman decided in accordance with the law in the Morris versus Economy Casualty case is simple. She decided, number one, that reasonable, as used in the context of our EUO provision, which is almost identical to the EUO provision as enunciated in the Morris case, was limited to time, was limited to number, was limited to frequency. It was not a limitation as to scope or subject matter, or as the Morris case noted and Judge Springman correctly cited, the word what. We know from time to time in the insurance industry that it is necessary to approach and to discuss and to interrogate and to question insureds about such subject matters that sometimes take longer than we would like. They're not meant to be harassing, but in a case that was as complex as this, there was no way to get through it in 3 hours, 5 hours, 8 hours, or a day. We knew as the case progressed during the course of the UO that additional documents would have to be produced and would have to be addressed. And as you probably noted from the record, the proof of loss continued to increase from $100,000 to $300,000 to $500,000 based upon these documents that they were continuing to supplement. I had no obligation, and in my opinion would have done an injustice to my client had I agreed to the terms that Mr. Bieberstadt arbitrarily set without any regard to the contract language, that I agree not just to rehash questions. His words were subject matter. That's as broad as you can get in this capacity, subject matter. And I agreed to those terms, I literally would have been precluded from talking about business loss, loss of income, value of embroidery designs, all those subject matters that he had put in his letter, and also in terms of a three-hour limitation, which arguably with 1,200 documents would have been a mistake on my part because I cannot foresee the future. I cannot agree to that. He did put that in drop-dead terms. He did say, we are not going to participate in another EUO unless you agree to these terms. And then he filed suit in federal court. And it was at that point we decided that it was in our client's best interest to file a motion for summary judgment because he had made it clear that he would not agree to any other terms. It's as simple as that. Morris versus Economy Casualty is clear. It's an Indiana Supreme Court case. It is directly on point. The policy language is almost identical. And there is no reason why this court, under the circumstances, has to address this with the Indiana Supreme Court further. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. How much time does Mr. Bieberstadt have? Thank you.
This was not a complicated case. Within a month of this loss, Westfield, to their credit, had hired a consultant who had determined what the cost would be to reproduce these design libraries. He arrived at a number of $6 to $10 per 1,000 stitches. His report made an error in terms of the number of files that were in the library and the number of stitches per file. The number of files error, both of these errors were brought to his attention right away. He changed the one number. He didn't change the number of stitches per file. Within a month of this case, of this loss, the dispute between the parties boiled down to what is the average number of stitches per file, per embroidery design. Westfield waited over 5 months to ask Mr. Snyder to send documentation of that, and he immediately sent it to them. And it was after that that this, in fact, when he sent it to them, what happened is 9 days later he gets a letter from Westfield saying we're not going to pay anymore based on Mr. Spetter's evaluation. And it was a little odd because it was only 9 days after he'd sent 2,500 pages of documents to him. And then 9 days later, Mr. Spetter leaves a message on Mr. Snyder's answering machine saying, why did you send these 2,500 pages of documents to me? And then after that, this 7-hour questioning took place. That is the context in terms of which led to the request that we put some type of parameters on what's going to happen. I would encourage you to look at the correspondence between Mr. Clark and myself, because although I may have started out a little strong in my first letter where I used the word subject matter, look at what I said in his letter came back saying, I want to cover all the new materials, but I don't want to be limited to that. And my response to him was, that's fine. You can cover all the new materials. I just want you to agree not to rehash questions that had already been asked. I wasn't precluding entire subject matters. If the question had already been asked and answered, I don't think he has the right to ask it again. That's what the rules of evidence say. He wouldn't agree to that. And when he insisted on a second day of questioning and refused to agree to what we all know are common rules of evidence and what happens in statements under oath, which are tantamount to a deposition under the Jones case, then the question arose, was it reasonably required to have the second day of questioning? That's a jury question. This court has said only in extreme cases is the question of reasonableness one for summary judgment. Is this an extreme case? Hardly. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bieberstedt. Our thanks indeed to both counsel in the case, and it will be taken under advisement.